And we are here today with Tom McDonald to talk about life, the universe, and everything life from a universe. Catholic perspective. Helped along by, I just want to start this just because this is so great. So there was a piece in the New Yorker today by a guy named, what's his name? I just saw it. At least I think it's a guy. It might be a woman. I don't know. Arie Cohen Wade. I don't know if that's a man's sexist name or a woman's name. Sorry, I just don't know. Not up on Hebraic names. So whoever you are, Arie, it's R-A-R-Y-E-H. So if somebody wants to go out there and do a Google search and find out who that person is, Cohen hyphen Wade. Anyway, the very talented Arie Cohen Wade just wrote up a number of Shakespearean soliloquies as delivered by Donald Trump. I just wanted to read one of them just because they all killed me. They were so funny. So, friends, Romans, folks, listen up. The reason I'm here is to bury Julius. It's not to praise him. It's just not. Brutus over there, we all know he's a good guy, right? And he says Julius was low energy. Is it a crime to be low energy? Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Who knows? The point is, Brutus is a good guy. All these guys over there, the ones who did this, they're all good guys. And Julius was my friend and a really terrific friend to me. Julius, he brought a lot of captives home to Rome, filled a lot of coffers, really fantastic coffers. Does that sound low energy to you? And when the poor people, regular, hardworking, everyday Romans cried, Julius did too. He cried. I saw it with my own eyes many, many times. But Brutus says Julius was low energy. And everyone knows that Brutus is a good guy, right? You all saw that on the Lupercal three times I tried to give Julius a kingly crown. And you should have seen this crown. This is a great crown, okay? Very kingly. And three times he said, nope. Is this low energy? Yet, Brutus says he was low energy, and sure, Brutus is a good guy. I'm not here to say Brutus is lying, but I am here to speak what I do know. You all loved Julius once, so why not be a little sad now that he's dead? Just a little sad. I'm sorry to say that the Roman Senate has been run by a bunch of morons for a long time. Morons! A lot of bad decisions these guys, they make. They're like a bunch of animals. It makes me so sad, so sad. And I'm looking here at the coffin of my good friend, Mr. Caesar. Just a minute. Pauses to wipe a tear from his eye. So, we're going to build a wall. And who's going to pay for it? The crowd shouts, the Visigoths! End of soliloquy. They're all awesome. Like, I could go on and on, but I won't.
At least you know it'll be an interesting 4 years.
I hope. I hope it's not that interesting. That's the Chinese curse kind of interesting. But anyway, so there it is. If you go to the New Yorker website, you can find all the rest of these soliloquies. He's got one from Macbeth, and he has, of course, the to be or not to be speech. I'm giving into temptation here. Listen, to be or not to be, this is a tough question, okay? Very tough. A lot of people come up to me and ask, Donald, what's more noble, getting hit every day with the slings, the bows, the arrows, the sea of troubles, or just giving up? I mean, smart people, the best Ivy League schools. But I say to them, have you ever thought that we don't know? We don't know what dreams may come. Have you ever thought about that? Ay, 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 there's the rub. There's the rub right there. When we shuffle off this mortal, whatever it is, coil, they say to me, Donald, you built this fantastic company. How'd you do it? How? And I say one word, leadership, because that's what it is all about, is leadership. And people are so grateful wherever I bring up this whole perchance to dream thing. So grateful. And on with the whips and the scorns of time and the contumely and the fartles and the blah, blah, blah. Then I see a bear bodkin and I'm like, a bodkin? What the hell is this thing, a bodkin? Listen, I run a very successful business. I employ thousands of people, and I'm supposed to care whether this bodkin is bare or not? Sad. And when people say I have a conscience, trust me, I have a conscience, and it's a very big conscience, okay? And the native hue of my resolution is not sickly door. That's a lie. If anyone tells you that the native hue of my resolution is sickly door, they're trying to sell you a load of you-know-what and enterprises of great pith. Listen, my enterprises are so pithy, fantastic pith. And sometimes, hey, they lose the name of action, right? I mean, it happens. It happens. So,
I have never, I have to say, I've never actually listened to him enough to know if that's accurate or not.
It is spot on.
Is it?
Oh, it's uncanny.
Really?
Yes. It's
I might have to listen to him more then. It sounds vastly entertaining.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this is, of course, there's a long history of this kind of thing. Years and years ago, back in the 50s, somebody reworked the Gettysburg Address as it would have been delivered by Dwight Eisenhower. Oh, man, is it funny. But I don't have that in front of me, so you are spared.
spared more. Spared,
yeah, some time ago, I think it was 87 years or so, some individuals got together and organized a governmental setup. That's how it starts, and it's just...
Oh my.
So how you doing?
How am I doing? I'm doing okay. I can't complain. Well, I could, but who'd care, really? Actually, we've got nice weather finally, so
that's good.
Yeah, New Jersey doesn't tend to have very nice summers usually. It usually goes straight into heat and moisture and terrible things on the death and the bugs. But nothing much interesting. I actually got a couple of blog posts up the last couple of weeks, and I'm kind of stalled on the next one. But I've got a lot of stuff I'm going to be working on. The last thing I did was the Bible passages thing, and there's going to be two or three more of those as people write in and give me more. Okay. Difficult Bible passages is the idea.
Bible passages.
Yeah, things that, you see on memes from atheists.
Right.
You know,
so you got a couple of those. I mean, the one with the bears eat the kids.
That's an easy one. That gets done a lot.
Yeah, I
found more interesting one, though. I found amputation for touching a man's genitals. I bet nobody had done that one before.
it's so important. This is what keeps connecting the dots on the cutting edge of Catholic talk radio. Just as it were, so to speak, after a fashion, if you get my meaning, if you catch my...
I get it. It was cutting edge, and we made a joke.
That's good. Well, there's the great passage from Paul. When people say, we should talk more like the apostles, they generally don't mean we should go around wishing that our enemies would castrate themselves, as Paul did. But wouldn't you love to hear a bishop give a homily?
Oh, I wish it was in the readings,
Well, in this passage, Paul, I have something in my throat, excuse me. That is, in fact, what Paul does. He's writing in a fit of pique to the Galatians. For those of you who are not familiar with this particular passage, it's in Galatians. And Paul is miffed because he's just gotten word that the Galatians are basically people living in Asia Minor. And there's an ongoing sort of fracas in the early church about it's something that no modern Catholic ever has to struggle with, the question of who's the greatest Catholic of them all. Don't have that problem anymore, but in the early church these primitive savages did, and people who were so unlike us in so many ways. And so it was very natural for the first claim to who's the greatest Catholic of them all to be Jewish Catholics saying to Gentile Catholics, yeah, we're way better than you because we're Jews, and Jesus was a Jew, So, I mean, he was circumcised, we're circumcised, so obviously,
Right.
Two plus two equals four. We're obviously way better than Gentiles who are not circumcised. And if Gentiles really want to get serious about being real Catholics, they need to be circumcised and keep kosher and do all the other things that Jews do. Or they're just not really, just second class, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that was a very common temptation in the early church, and Paul has to battle that. And then he gets word that the Galatians are caving into this, and his head explodes, and he writes a letter called the Letter to the Galatians, in which he basically just writes them and says, have you people lost your minds? Are you crazy? And he just chews them out. And then he goes on a tear about the guys who have come to Galatia to inform them that they're all second-class citizens and need to get it together. And in a in a startling oratorical turn, he says, as for those who are deceiving you, I wish they would go all the way and mutilate themselves or castrate themselves.
If you're talking about circumcision, finish the job is basically what he's saying.
Right. So, yes, Paul is, and he himself says, I am at the end of my rope about you. Well, we can do this discussion. We can do it with the brain. But Tom McDonald will be talking about after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Oh, my darling. Oh, my darling. Clementine.
Oh, we're back.
Hello. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Tom McDonald. Tom, you wrote a piece for the National Catholic Register on five hard Bible passages and what they mean. Yeah.
There are lots of them. I only picked five, but I'm going to do more.
I'm wondering how you pared it down to five. I mean,
well, I've got the others. I just tried to get them for diversity and some that get tackled a lot and some that don't and some that might have some interesting exegesis. And of course, I heard from the peanut gallery, like, your exegesis isn't very convincing. It's like, oh, find another one then. I don't care. You get what you pay for. Did you pay for this exegesis? No, it was free. You just click the link, so go away.
You suck. You know,
I mean, I'm not as used to hearing that as you are, but, it's kind of part and parcel of, writing about any of this stuff is being told how awful you are.
I always have a notion that, somewhere in the back of the crowd at the feeding of the 5,000, there was at least one guy who said, I don't like sourdough. This tastes like sourdough.
There's someone in the back, like Leif O'Brien.
What? No butter?
Did he say, blessed are the cheesemakers?
It's impossible to please everybody. You just can't do it. So,
yeah. See, the difficult thing with this whole Bible thing is that it's progressive revelation to a people who were being ushered from savagery to salvation, and that the Old Testament is part of the story of that. So you have to not look at it like it's disconnected from the New Testament. This is where you get into heresies, the Manichees, the Montanists? Who else was against putting the Old Testament in?
The Montanists in particular, not the Montanists. Who am I thinking of?
Well, the Manichees, certainly.
No. Actually, not the
The Gnostics.
Marcionites.
Marcionism.
The Marcionites. Yes. I knew it was an M guy.
Yeah.
The guy, right. Irenaeus, one of my favorite patristic insults, actually. Tertullian.
Right.
Tertullian, who was kind of up there with Jerome in terms of yes. knowing how to not as good as Jerome, I think, but up there with Jerome in terms of how to wield a poison pen. Yeah. And in the Marcion was actually the son of a bishop who came up with theories. He had theories, Tom. Very good. The best theories, okay? Using the best words. And so he decided that he didn't like Jews, first of all. He was one of the original anti-Semites in the history of the church. Because he didn't like Jews, he didn't like their God either. So he came up with this theory. And the theory was basically the God of the Old Testament was bad.
Right.
And Jesus was here to deliver us from the God of the Old Testament. And so he offered a sanitized for your protection New Testament, got rid of the Old Testament because we don't want the Jewish stuff. And then he sanitized the New Testament, got rid of all the Old Testament citations in the New Testament, issued one gospel, the only good one, in his view, which was Luke. And that was because he was a huge fan of Paul properly corrected and sanitized for your protection. So he got rid of all the Old Testament citations for Paul, which basically leaves practically nothing of what Paul has to say, because Paul is just completely immersed in the Old Testament. That was his Bible that he promulgated. Well, Tertullian remarks on him later on and says that Marcion had, quote, a pumpkin in place of a brain.
Yes.
Which has its own certain charm. Yeah. But yeah, so this urge to get rid of the Old Testament and anything Jewish lurks around in the background.
Well, you know, and that's aligned well with Gnosticism, because they imagined a demiurge, a lesser creator god that informed the Old Testament. So they didn't care for it either. But one thing I've been spending a lot of time over the last few years with, and I actually wrote a piece for Homiletic and Pastoral Review on it, is Benedict's third way of canonical criticism, in which he is trying to correct the both the errors of overly pious interpretations and exegesis and of the excesses of historical criticism, you know, and
right.
Because both of them can go too far.
Sure.
And what Benedict has found is that you can use some of the tools of modern so-called scientific criticism, of some of the language tools, and weld them to a Catholic understanding into a canonical criticism, which sees the Bible as a totality, not as a series of separate entities or books or, you know, pericopes, which are the small sections in the Bible, you know, so that if you look at it as a totality, then you have to let one thing inform the other. So when you try to imagine the worst passage you come across, you know, being said by Jesus in that person, you know, and think, okay, now right. What does this say to me? You know, what does this right. mean? You know, and then you have to realize that some of it was the law of the time being, you know, laid down for people who were in a hostile country surrounded by people like the Canaanites who offered their children to Baal, you know, temple prostitution. Some say there was cannibalism. There's all kinds of things that the Jews were in the midst of in the Old Testament that
right. it really God was
trying to draw them out
wild, of. The Wild West was like civilized.
Yeah. Oh, nothing. Yeah.
The ancient Near East. You know.
Yeah, it was pretty horrible. So when you get down to this, you know, one of the big things, the you know, skeptics and anti-Christians bring up is genocide, of course, because, you know, you'll find several instances in which, you know, God is basically saying, destroy everybody you come across. And mm-hmm. by our standard, we really can't justify that by modern standards. We can't look at a loving God and say, kill everybody. What does that mean? And that's, you know, we rightly can't imagine it. Why can't we imagine it? Because a couple thousand years ago, God said, don't imagine that, and came along in the person of Christ and said, love your enemies.
Right.
And so people act like that 2000 intervening years hasn't shaped our mentalities and brought us to the point where we can be horrified at genocide, you know. But then when we look at the actual citations in the genocide passages, you know, smite the Amalekites and destroy all they have, do not spare them, kill man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. There's a couple of things in these passages that have to, you know, command our attention. And the first one is, and you find it especially, it's a story of Rahab, I guess. It's in the first, it's in Joshua, right? Where God commands them not to take anything. And we see this often. They're not allowed to take any spoils. They're not allowed to take any animals. They're not allowed to take anything, which has to be kind of matched with the command to kill everybody. What are they telling them? God's telling them don't wage war for profit. God is telling them don't wage war for spoils. So, you know, we find the passages where, you know, people disobey this.
It's bizarre, of course, to our ears.
Right.
But in its original context, this, the people who are saying this, staggeringly to us, regard this as an act of piety.
Sure.
Don't profit from this. This is not for you to go out and take this stuff for yourself.
Right, because that war spoils were the main source of main reason for waging war. Land and spoils. Yeah. So the other thing was, when we get down to it, what is the constant refrain of the story of the Jews? What is the thing that repeats over and over again? And that's the backsliding of the Jews into, you know, the ways of the people they're not supposed to be like, you know, acting like the Canaanites, worshiping foreign gods, slipping back into idolatry and other barbaric practices because they've left those people among them, because they didn't follow God's instruction.
Right.
You know, one of the things to realize about the genocide passages is most of them weren't followed. they weren't, you know, in many cases, they weren't all wiped out. And what was left was a remnant that, you know, in the time poisoned the Jewish people and led them astray. What was God's purpose? God's purpose was their salvation and their redemption, and to bring them and make them a special people, peculiarly his own. And if a remnant was left that would prevent that from happening with witchcraft, with idolatry, you know, with all of these things they were directly ordered not to do, everything abominable that the Lord hates. Mm-hmm. And then we're told that they do that in Deuteronomy, that the Jews, because they left these people, they did it. They burnt their sons and daughters in fires to the gods, we're told in Deuteronomy, you know. Right. So it's a hard truth. We're not comfortable with it. Good. I'm glad we're not comfortable with genocide. You know, that's bad. But we kind of have to look at all these things in historical context to make sense of it and what it meant to people at the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and we are looking at a revelation that's being made to a bunch of Bronze Age savages.
Sure.
And on their terms, because that's always the only terms you can work on. You know, that which is received according to the mode of the receiver, as the medievals said.
Right.
Well, we'll continue this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Tom McDonald right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
I'm your host, Mark Shea. You know, one of the things you were mentioning, we were talking about during the break, is the not occasional, but constant for like centuries, criticism that of Israel that characterizes Old Testament literature. And there's nothing like this in the national literature of other ancient peoples. When you read an Assyrian steel, you know, by a king, it's just, you know, man, am I awesome. Right. I went everywhere and I kicked butt and there's nobody like me, you know. And the Egyptians, you get the same kind of thing in their monumental work and in, you know, the records left behind. And Israelite literature is just, it's just this unrelenting torrent of criticism, not of our enemies. I mean, you get that, certainly. You get, you know, you sure. get, so you get prophetic books that chew out various enemies of Israel and call down curses on them and et cetera, et cetera. Curses which eventually come true in startling ways. But there's nothing in antiquity like the Israelite capacity for self-criticism, particularly through the prophets. It's just astounding to me when you read it. The harshest denunciations that you can find of Israel come from their own prophets.
Sure.
And because of it, I'm convinced it's one of the reasons that Israel... Have you met any Amorites lately? Not a lot of Babylonians, right? Out there, you know, right. Certainly there are peoples that descend from those peoples, but the Jews are remarkable in their staying power. Now, of course, chosen people, divine preservation, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. But I think part of it as well, and I've heard Jews themselves say this, you know, that capacity for self-criticism and the Jewish cherishing of wisdom over cunning has played no small part in their survival as a people. And I think that's absolutely true.
Sure. And Jesus stands in that prophetic treatment.
Sure.
Know? That prophetic tradition, he's quite obviously, you know, both John and Jesus, John is the bridge to the prophetic
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist, and Jesus is the culmination, you know, and the new beginning of it, because he condemns them like, you know, which of the prophets did not your father stone, you know?
Right.
So, but the interesting thing is that the rabbinicate and the Talmudic scholars, as they developed, also had problems with many of these passages and spent a great deal of time analyzing them and trying to come up with answers. I found one was one of the passages I had was from Deuteronomy. This was the first thing I covered, and I'll read you the passage so you could just have a cold. When men fight with one another, and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him, and puts her hand out and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall have no pity. Okay. Well, that's a curious one, isn't it?
Hey.
The scholars believed that they didn't like this passage, the rabbis, and they said, and it was a very, it's unconvincing. I forget which, I forget where I found it, but it's basically saying it's, she's to be fined the value of her hand or the weight of her hand in silver or something like that is how they interpreted it. And that's not particularly convincing, you know. Later on, the Torah, the Jewish Publication Society has a Torah commentary that distills a lot of Jewish interpretations down, and they're into kind of a sort of a consensus, I guess it's fair to say. And they said their meaning is that if a person's attacking someone in a potentially lethal way, you may wound the attacker if that is necessary to save the victim, and if that is not does not suffice, you may then kill the attacker. That's the Jewish interpretation of that passage. And it's all kind of, if you, you know, parse out the words and the letters, you can actually kind of get to that. You know, but there's lots of things in that passage. Crushing a man's privy parts could prevent him from, you know, having children, which in its own way is a death penalty in the ancient world for a man. Mm-hmm. You know, if he has no one to care for him in his old age, if he has no family, you know. So there's a lot of different things here. And the other problem is that passage was interesting because I had to burrow down. I do not know Hebrew, but I'm able to use my exegetical tools. And when you burrow down into it, the words, two different words are used for hand, for grab by the hand and cut off the hand, yad and kap in Hebrew. Okay. And the second one is polyvalent. It can mean a whole number of things, from hand to palm, the sole of the foot to hip socket, handful, or even like control, like he fell into his hands. So when you look at the passage in context, you find it follows immediately after the passage about the Levirate marriages, you know, mm-hmm. how a brother-in-law must marry the widow, his brother's widow, to give her children, and the punishments he will face if he doesn't, which included having his sandal pulled off and being spit in the face. I'm not kidding. That is one of the punishments for refusing the Levirate marriage, is the woman yanks off his sandal, hits him with it, and spits in his face. So what you're dealing with in all of these weird peculiarities is a lot of tribal custom. You're dealing with 3,000 years of changes in interpretation, understanding of the words, the letters themselves, the individual, you know, syllables and things.
Right, yeah.
What they mean, you know, the words
used. There's a reason Talmudic means...
Right.
It's finally parsed, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's what they do. Talmudic scholars, you know, go down to... what is it? I was going to say iota, but that's Greek. But the other small thing in Hebrew.
Well, jots and tittles, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you can get, I mean, you can even get into, I remember talking to a friend of mine, a Jewish convert to the faith, and he said, you know, you get in some schools of Jewish mysticism, there's even, you know, contemplation. I'm not making this up. Contemplation of the spaces between the letters.
Oh, sure.
And what God is revealing to us in the spaces between the letters of Holy Scripture. I mean, it's a different way
sure.
of looking at things than moderns are used to.
I'm not sure if Catholics are fully aware of this, but, you know, first of all, they don't technically, usually, pious Jews don't write the full name of God. It's either G hyphen D or some other thing. And second, when a Torah is disused, it can't be thrown away. And what you find in the ancient world are these rooms where they would put tatty old things with Hebrew scriptural writing on it. And they'd be kept in special rooms where... they were kind of considered garbage rooms in which they'd just be stored and stacked on each other, but they knew they would never be destroyed,
right?
You know? And so many, many years later, you find some of these rooms at some of these ancient spots, and they turn up this treasure trove of right. documents, because the word itself was holy. I don't mean me saying this word. I mean, literally the shape of the letter on the shape of the parchment was holy.
Yeah, well, and it's a piety. I mean, it's funny, of course, in the sense that it's a piety that carries through into Catholic piety. This is how we treat the Eucharist, you know?
Sure.
You don't just, we got some Eucharist left over, you know, we'll just, you know, chuck it in the garbage. That would never happen.
No.
It's the same kind of intense piety, except directed to scripture.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and there was, you know, there's early, you know, Jewish commentary, and, you know, the early schools believed that the world was brought into existence to bring the Torah into existence as a place to put this, you know, that creation existed for this. And that's why that's why John is such a thunderbolt. When we get to those first words, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's the bridge. The bridge from the first line to the new. And, we think of it and says, okay, that's good. The Jewish audience would have thought of that, and it would have turned themselves 180 right. into either believing it or really wanting to kill you. You know, right. Because you've said a horrible thing just there. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but there's a lot of, you know, there is a reason they spend so much time. And there's two Talmuds. Talmuds are kind of the commentaries on things. There's the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud. They're just generally slightly different compilations. And you can find them online, and you can see how, you know, they almost kind of played a, I don't want to say a game that solves a chore, but a rhetorical thing, we'll call it, in which they tried to see how many different interpretations they could come up for a single passage, you know, because spinning these passages into different, more elaborate understandings, or, you know, it was almost, you know, this rabbi said this, this one said this, this one said this. It was almost competitive to some degree. It's like a rap battle. But that's really trivial. But okay. No, you get the idea, is that there's this definite, you know, there's definitely a sense that this can be understood in many, many different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is that moment in John's gospel where the word was made flesh, where Torah is made flesh, is exactly the, you know, the thunderbolt that the gospel has to say. And there, it's one of those things where it was impossible for his hearers, for Jesus's hearers or the apostles' hearers, to just say, well, you have your truth and I have mine. You know? We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Tom McDonald in just a jiffy.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Where Tom McDonald and I are talking about, well, some of the darker and more difficult passages of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is chock-a-block with difficult passages,
right?
And for various reasons, but a huge amount of it often has to do with the fact that we simply do not think the way the original author is thinking. The way the reader is going to hear this passage. You know, for me, and this is true with the New Testament too, Josh Billings said, it ain't what people know that's the problem, it's what they know that ain't so.
Right.
So when you hear Matthew recording the crowd at the trial of Jesus saying, let his blood be on us and on our children, we're sure we know what Matthew means in recording that. He means us to hear that the Jews called down a curse on themselves, and so now they're accursed. And this is one of those things that mean Matthew wants us to hear because he hates the Jews. Well, none of this is true. Matthew is a Jew himself.
Right.
He's writing to a Jewish audience, not trying to persuade them that they're accursed. He's trying to persuade them that Jesus is the Messiah. And what he's doing there is he's making use of something that John is very, very fond of, which is divine irony.
Right.
So when, in John's gospel, when Caiaphas says it is better that one man die than that the whole nation should perish, Caiaphas winds up saying the truth accidentally or by divine providence. He ironically tells the truth about who Jesus is. And what Matthew wants us to see is that that's what the mob does. May his blood be on us and on our children is, in Matthew's understanding, it's not a curse, it's a Eucharistic prayer.
Sure.
What do we pray every time we ask every time we bring our kids up to make their first communion and they receive the cup? May his blood be on us and on our children.
Right.
And so Matthew's employing divine irony there. But if we're not thinking in the terms that Matthew does, we're going to totally miss that ironic inclusion of the cry of the mob and what Matthew hears in it. Right. Because we're already sure we know. So, sorry, interruption, but
no,
I wanted...
That's good. No.
So... It, talk about Elisha and the Bears.
Elisha and the Bears. I think, to me, the story is funny, and everybody is usually horrified by it, so probably says more about me than it does about the Bible or everyone else. But the passage is, Elisha went up from there to Bethel, and while he was going up on the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, saying, "Go up, you bald head. Go up, you bald head." That's funny. And he turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. And two she-bears, why she-bears? That's an interesting detail, came out of the woods and tore 42 of the boys. Well, let's start with 42. Let's start at the end, since 42 is a symbolic number almost certainly. Okay. We find it in Kings. It's the number of people killed by Jehu. The Babylonian Talmud says an interpretation of this is that 42 was the number of sacrifices by Balak of Moab, and that this was meant to be, you know, a parallel to that, that their parents of these children were, you know, monsters, that this was the payment against these children. Early exegesis, though, often doesn't regard this as literal. One is that it's a pedagogic tale, the presence of the children and the terribleness of the curse, which bothered Talmudic scholars. Actually, they found the calling down the Lord to use an animal to tear 42 children apart. They thought it was meant to be didactic, to tell children to respect a prophet and his words and his being. There's also a variant in, there's something called the Lukianic recension of the Septuagint, which is just a variant, which has they stoned rather than they mocked Elisha, so that they were attempting to kill Elisha. There's another one. And by the way, these are all variants. It's, you know, there's different ways of approaching it. So, you know, pick the one you like. This is what exegesis does. It does try to arrive at the best, but along the way, you know, we kind of arrive at multiple solutions. What was the other one? Oh, the baldness. Was he bald? That's actually kind of a point to think about. Was he really bald, or had he shaved his head in lamentation for Elijah? If the baldness was, you know, an act of a man in grief, then the mockery wasn't directed at his baldness, and he wasn't just vain George Costanza type. he was being mocked because it disrespected the prophet. It disrespected Elijah, and it disrespected the prophetic gift of God. It injured the honor of the Lord himself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that to think about as well.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, generally when you run into a story like this, the what you should assume is that there's a lot going on here that you're not seeing. There's a lot being suggested here that you're not seeing. So I remember I read something the other day by a woman who, to her surprise, had found herself becoming a Christian after being a contented atheist all of her life. And of course, as she was doing this, she was trying to figure out all these biblical stories that she's reading, and she said she turned to her Christian friends and said, "Why did Jesus ice that fig tree?"
I'm going to do that one too.
and you know, if you come to it, I remember talking to a friend of mine years ago, and he was baffled by this. Why does Jesus kill a tree? That's just so weird. Why would he? It's like he just lost his. He was just having a bad day, right? And, you know, when you're the son of God, you're having a bad day, you just take it out on a fig tree. Just a, you know, and it was really kind of funny, just because, you know, that there's got to be some larger context here that I'm missing.
Right.
But I have no idea what it is.
Oh, no, I think that one's understandable. I think you've got...
Oh, I understand what it is, but...
Yes, okay. I was thinking...
I get the context.
Yeah, no, you get it. I kind of thought so. No, I know. It's one of those things you have to kind of slow down and think, and it's meant... That's not a bad thing. Thought isn't necessarily bad, people. <You know? laughs> So if it seems to you that something horrifying is going on in Scripture, and you say... You know, what's that all about? know, think maybe the problem is you, not the scripture. That maybe you've misunderstood something. Maybe the intervening years have clouded it. I mean, we still don't know what Selah means, or Selah, the cue in the Psalms. It's probably some kind of musical thing. Like, maybe it means solo. Maybe that's where they had a really ripping guitar solo from their Eddie Van Halen. you know, who knows?
I choose to believe that that is what it means. I'm going
to
just
believe that. Well, I just thought of that, actually, but I think that's from now on. That's what I'm going to tell people. Next time a student asks me what it means, I said that means guitar solo.
That's a guitar solo.
that's when the lyrist would go into eruption.
Steve Howe, take it away. Yeah. Okay, well, that is really good. And yeah, it's true. Scripture is amazingly economical in the way it expresses itself, and it crams so much subtlety into what's being spoken. I have a talk that I do on the Blessed Mother, which unfortunately we can't get into now, but one of the things that you discover just reading through the first four chapters of the book of John is there is crammed into that whole thing a massive amount of information about Christ and his nuptial relationship to the church. Christ is the bridegroom. And over and over again, you run into this, and it's packed in there. It's like the DNA crammed into the nucleus of a cell. You know, if you untwine it, it stretches 30 miles, and it's all scrunched into this tiny little piece of text. And the Old Testament is this way as well. There's all kinds of things being spoken there that you're expected to get via allusion, and you don't get it because you don't know what's being alluded to.
Right.
It would be like somebody, you know, from 1,000 years in the future coming, showing up in our time, and everybody looks at him, you know, and makes a wisecrack about Anakin Skywalker. And he's like, what? You know? I don't get it. Everybody in our culture gets it because we've all seen Star Wars. And it's exactly the same in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is constantly doing this. And the New Testament, even more so, is just cram-packed with allusions to Old Testament ideas and images and connections. And so much of it goes right over our heads because we don't know the Old Testament. This is why it's so important to get past these kind of bugbears, or she-bears in this case, and really... learn what the Old Testament has to say, because that's the reading. Our producer today was Ethan. Our director of music was Ludwig van Beethoven, and we'll be back tomorrow.